With all due respect, Mr. Ambassador, you shouldn't be here.
That's Vice President Mike Pence this week at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on Venezuela. He called for the elected president, Nicolas Maduro, to be replaced by opposition leader Juan Guaido.
The time has come for the United Nations to recognize interim President Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela and seat his representative in this body. This body should revoke the credentials of Venezuela's representative to the United Nations, recognize interim President Juan Guaido, and seat the representative of the Free Venezuelan government in this body without delay. With all due respect, Mr. Ambassador, you shouldn't be here. You should return to Venezuela and tell Nicolas Maduro that his time is up.
Pence repeated the phrase, all options are on the table. But Russia's UN ambassador accused the U.S. of provoking the crisis in order to replace an elected leader with what he called an American pawn. The council took no action, but did discuss Venezuela's humanitarian crisis. 3 million people, roughly 10% of the population, have left Venezuela in the past few years. That leaves 87% of remaining citizens in poverty. Starting in January, the Trump administration put sanctions on Venezuelan oil. Here again, Vice President Pence.
And since oil is the lifeblood of that corrupt regime, the United States of America sanctioned Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA. And today, we're taking action against a vital source of the Maduro regime's wealth. At the direction of President Donald Trump, the United States of America will sanction 34 vessels owned or operated by PDVSA, as well as two additional companies that transport Venezuelan crude oil to Cuba. Venezuela's oil belongs to the Venezuelan people.
Philip Reeves is NPR's South American correspondent. He spent much of the last 2 years in Venezuela, and he joins us today from Rio. Philip, great to have you on our program.
Thank you for inviting me.
What do you think is going to be the impact of these sanctions just added last week?
Well, there's not much doubt that the sanctions imposed by the U.S., particularly the ones on oil, which were imposed in January, are going to be very severe in their impact. The oil sanctions essentially remove a big chunk of the foreign export income upon which the Maduro government relies. And they've lost that. Further pressure has been applied more recently by attempts to cut off Venezuela's ability to send oil to Cuba, for example, and also there are individual sanctions against visas and in the banking area and more. And they're all squeezing the government of Nicolas Maduro, and they all add to the pressure and make it harder to figure out exactly how he's managing to continue.
Let's hear more from Vice President Pence about America's goals.
To that end, the United States will continue to exert all diplomatic and economic pressure to bring about a peaceful transition to democracy. But those looking on should know this. All options are on the table. And Nicolas Maduro would do well not to test the resolve of the United States.
Philip Reeves, is that the kind of transition that the Venezuelan people are looking for, especially with the rise of Juan Guaido?
Well, it depends who you talk to. I mean, Juan Guaido, the opposition leader, who is recognized by the U.S. and by more than 50 other countries, very much see that as the goal that they would like. Guaido, under his plan, would become the head of a transitional government that would then move towards free and fair elections. The basis for that argument is that the elections that delivered a second term for Maduro were fraudulent.
Tell me more about Juan Guaido. Maduro may have been elected by a fraudulent process, but he, Guaido, hasn't been elected at all.
He has not. He's invoked a clause in the Constitution that says essentially that because of that fraudulent election, that he, as President of the National Assembly, is entitled to step in and become an interim president and lead the country towards new elections. However, he is that in name only. The power completely rests still in the hands of Maduro. He controls the key organs of state, the military and the security agencies. Guaido's a young guy. He's 35 years old. He's an industrial engineer by training. He came out of nowhere. 6 months ago, almost no one in Venezuela had heard of him. He belongs to the political party Popular Will, and since appearing on the landscape and in January in front of this massive crowd in Caracas, taking an oath that in which he assumed the presidency, as it were, he has become very popular. He's getting in the polls at least 60%, and his popularity is probably greater than that. And he has proved himself to be quite a charismatic operator. He seems to have a popular touch, and he's admired widely by Venezuelans. But on the other hand, you do meet people who still aren't convinced by him, although would regard him as preferable right now to Maduro.
We're talking leadership, we're talking politics, we're talking government. You spent a lot of time in Venezuela. What is the condition of people there if, in fact, 87% of the population lives in poverty?
It's tragic. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. There are dire shortages, as everyone knows, of food. I think the even more serious issue is the shortage of medicine and increasingly the shortage of water. Last month, there was one which in some areas went on for 6 days. So people are focusing really a lot of the time simply on the struggle to survive. And that raises the question as to whether they have the sufficient energy, really, sufficient resources to stand up to the Maduro government and to press the Maduro government to leave, especially given the fact that more than 3 million Venezuelans have left the country. So some of those people who might be expected to take the initiative in opposing Maduro are no longer on the landscape.
You said that Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez, still regarded as a good leader by a lot of people. Maduro obviously has been a failure in so many ways. But what happened? In what ways have things gotten worse because of Maduro?
Well, one thing that really changed the whole scenario was the collapse in oil prices. Since 2014, Venezuela's income has been plummeting, but it's also a society that is blighted by government ineptitude and corruption on an operatic scale. And as things have begun to crumble and deteriorate, and as people have left, a lot of expertise in the oil industry, in the utilities industries generally, have also left, people going, engineers, experts of other kinds, leaving the country to try to find jobs elsewhere. So sustaining the country as a sort of functioning entity has become increasingly harder. Maduro has also farmed out, if you like, a lot of economic opportunities, very often illegal ones, to the people that he requires to support him. So he's handed control of the state-run oil company, for example, to the military. The military are also cut in on illicit gold mining operations, giving them the opportunity to gain revenue by smuggling. They're believed to be involved in the narcotics business. And so it's gradually morphed into this inept, dysfunctional, and corrupt society, which is Venezuela that we now see with the results that we now see today.
In many corrupt societies, the military is a bulwark of the regime, and Venezuela's no exception. So I asked Philip Reeves about reports that some factions of the military there are opposing Maduro, even supporting Juan Guaido.
Well, we've seen some defections to Guaido among the junior ranks. Hundreds have crossed recently into Colombia from Venezuela. According to the Colombian Foreign Ministry, at least 1,000, but they're mostly junior soldiers. The key issue is the military high command. There's a consensus that if the military high command stops supporting Maduro, then Maduro will swiftly fall from power. So far, they have stood firm, despite Guaido's offer of amnesty. Many observers believe that one big part of that is because of the presence in the military of many Cuban intelligence agents. Over 2,000 are believed to be in Venezuela. They're believed to monitor the military. So any senior military officer who might be contemplating switching sides would be aware that he's likely to be under surveillance by the Cubans and would therefore be taking a risk. Remembering also that the Cubans would be aware of any illicit activities that officer may or may not be involved in. And so it's often argued that because of the presence of the Cubans, that is one big reason why the military's senior officers have remained so far at Maduro's side.
You mentioned Colombia. What role is it playing other than taking refugees from Venezuela?
Well, the Colombians are a big part in the international alliance that has sided with the United States, especially in Latin America, to support and recognize Guaido. The interesting and fascinating thing about this story, it isn't just a question of a government saying that we don't recognize one president and that's it. They no longer recognize Maduro, and they recognize someone else, which makes it a very unusual story. And among the nations that have done that are the big players in most of the big players in Latin America, by which I mean Brazil, now under Jair Bolsonaro, a right-winger who is firmly opposed to Maduro, and also Colombia. So they're a big player in this, and of course one of the roles they're playing is that they are the location of humanitarian aid that the U.S. has parked on the border in the hope that Guaido would be able to bring it in to Venezuela. He attempted to do that, and that attempt failed, delivering what was at the time, and I think is still viewed by Maduro as a victory for Maduro, because he was able to block that attempt.
Sort of a contradiction here, it seems to me, that on the one hand, the United States is providing humanitarian aid, or wants to, and has it in Colombia ready to go if Maduro would only let it in. The Secretary of State, Pompeo, has said that we're the most generous country in the world. On the other hand, at the same time, we have invoked these sanctions, which have caused a situation where 87% of the people in Venezuela are in poverty. So it's not just the ineptitude of the government that's caused that. Sort of a contradiction as far as the United States is concerned.
Yes, it has to be said that the poverty and widespread suffering of the Venezuelan population predates the U.S. sanctions. The sanctions that really matter, Warren, are the ones on oil. That's, you know, cut a large chunk of income, separated a large chunk of income away from the Maduro government. And people were in big trouble in much of the country before that. But there's no doubt that these sanctions are going to kick in and bite very hard in the coming months. And there is a real debate internationally about whether that strategy of making the suffering of the Venezuelan people worse is one that is going to deliver any results apart from increasing human misery and maybe even removing the capability of the population to stand up against Maduro. That's a debate that's going on right now. It's quite possible that what Maduro will do in his efforts to survive is to continue to distribute largesse, such as it is in Venezuela at the moment, to the people who support his regime in practical terms, the military, the security agents, the senior members of the Socialist Party, and just let the population get poorer and poorer, which would mean that more of them would flow out into the neighboring countries, and Colombia, which has been particularly hard hit by this, would have even more of a burden to bear.
You talked about the international support for Juan Guaido, and that's certainly true within Central and South America, as you indicated. There are other countries involved, however, on the Maduro side, including China and Russia. What about them?
Well, indeed. And this is one of the areas where I think the Maduro government draws solace. They have the support of the Russians. The Russians sort of symbolically demonstrated that very recently by flying in two large military jets with roughly 100 military personnel and some military equipment on board into Caracas International Airport, immediately drawing the ire of Washington. And they've done that several times before, including with a couple of nuclear-capable bombers earlier this year. The Russians do have big interests in oil and gas there. But whether the whether this is simply about that or whether we're witnessing a geopolitical play is an area of some debate, and it is my view that the Russians are using Venezuela as a kind of arena in the US's backyard in which to indulge in a certain amount of geopolitical posturing by way of bringing pressure, countering that which they view is being brought upon them in their backyard, particularly in Ukraine.
Now, U.S. officials have been talking tough about the Russian presence in Venezuela. Here's President Trump's special envoy, Elliot Abrams, a diplomat with a long history in South and Central America.
I would just say that we have options, and that I think it would be a mistake for the Russians to think they have a free hand here. They don't.
President Trump has talked tough as well.
What sort of complications does the Russian involvement now pose?
Russia has to get out. All right, what's your next question?
So, the president didn't go into detail, but there have been reports that the U.S. might move troops into Colombia to respond to the Russians. Philip Reeves, any evidence of that?
Well, I'm not aware of that. And whenever U.S. officials get asked about anything involving military involvement or intervention, they always say all options are on the table, but at the same time, we're not planning to do that. And it is certainly important to emphasize that no one in the region wants it. I mean, the Latin American countries that support the U.S. in this don't want it, and the Europeans don't want it either. And it's easy to figure out the risk that would attend any kind of military action in Venezuela. It's twice the size of Iraq. Lots of territory in Venezuela is not under government control. There are non-state actors all over the place, people with guns, whether they're Colombian guerrilla groups or whether they are criminal gangs involved in narcotics or gold smuggling. So the potential for something like that going bad is extremely high.
What about China?
Well, China has a huge investment in Venezuela. It's lent the Venezuelans something like $60 billion over the last decade. And the general view tends to be that the Chinese are mostly interested in getting that money back, and that's the limit of their interest. And so whatever the outcome is, so long as they get their money back with that, then they would be ultimately content. Having said that, some of their political behavior in recent weeks and months has somewhat contradicted that. There was a very interesting incident very recently when the American Interdevelopment Bank was due to meet in China. And one of the people going to that meeting was a representative of Juan Guaido, who in the eyes of 54 nations in the world would be the legitimate Venezuelan government, although not in the eyes of the Chinese. And so they refused to give that representative a visa. And as a result of that, the meeting got canceled. And also during the power cuts that I mentioned, the Chinese were talking about helping Venezuela restore the grid. And there have been other comments about U.S. interference, which suggests that the Chinese do have a political position on this, that they are which they are asserting, and which all of the while that is going on gives Maduro some reason to hope and to tell his followers that they are not isolated. They have the Russians and they have the Chinese, big players on the map, not to mention Iran, Turkey, and Cuba.
There is said to be a 75-page regime change manual somewhere in the bowels of the U.S. Agency for International Development that would join with the CIA and other kinds of forces, special forces perhaps, to try to counteract Russia or to overturn Maduro or to undertake some kind of escalation of America's presence in the country. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about it, but I do know that that piece of information alone would not sort of cause that many raised eyebrows in Latin America, because as you know, Warren, the history of American intervention in this region is quite a long one, and it is one that is definitely sort of playing a part in creating the conditions in which this conflict is playing out. It's very easy to simply represent it as a country whose economy's collapsed, there's a humanitarian crisis, there's an inept and corrupt and repressive government in place, it has to go, that the narrative. In the mix, there is a whole history of, a whole kind of legacy of, or a deep institutional memory, if you like, of U.S. involvement in the region, Chile, Operation Condor, Panama, Grenada. This is all remembered in the neighborhood. And it is all, of course, part of the narrative that the Chavistas and that Maduro's government sell to the public. So when anyone raises the possibility that there is a plan involving the CIA to bring about regime change there, not many people would be surprised by that news.
For those who don't remember, let's just very briefly go over some of those instances of American intervention, starting in Chile. Operation Condor?
Operation Condor was when the U.S. and the CIA gave its support to South American right-wing governments, dictatorships, that were sharing information in the quest to arrest leftists and militant groups who, once arrested, in some cases suffered terrible fates. And it's still remembered around here, and it's added to that list, which includes Chile and, of course, Panama, which some people would say was a success, but it's important to remember that it was a much smaller country than Venezuela.
That was when they had an invasion that removed a dictatorial leader.
Yes, indeed. So when you talk to supporters of Guaido, who are becoming frustrated by the length of time that all this is taking, they do talk, hopefully, about military intervention, and they do sometimes refer to Panama as being an example of what the outcome might be. But the conditions are very different.
What was the role of the CIA with regard to the Allende regime in Chile?
Well, they collaborated in a coup that led to the takeover of the military and the arrival in power of Augusto Pinochet. And this is something that the left in Latin America hasn't forgotten and will cite as one of a number of examples of U.S. intervention in the region.
Now, foreign aid is controversial, but it's a tiny part of the U.S. budget. Nevertheless, Washington likes to boast about its generosity. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
America remains the most generous nation in the world when it comes to humanitarian assistance and, more broadly, assistance to countries all around the globe. And when Venezuela turns the corner, it will be America, along with the countries in the region, who are there to make sure that there's long-term support for the success of the Venezuelan people.
So the U.S. has aid ready to go to Venezuela. It's on the Colombian border now. At the same time, we're imposing sanctions. Is American benevolence, Philip Reeves, credible in Venezuela?
Well, I think among many Venezuelans, including those who don't at all like Maduro and the repressive government that he heads, regard the U.S. with some degree of suspicion. And Maduro, by the way, makes hay with this. I mean, you turn on state-run television, you very rarely see anything much about Guaido and the demonstrations that he holds against Maduro, but you'll hear an awful lot from Maduro. Much rhetoric, usually delivered in front of a crowd of cheering supporters or a bunch of soldiers that he's parading with, in which he constantly talks about the conspiracy against Venezuela by the imperialists and characterizes Venezuela as a sovereign, independent nation. That's an attempt to trigger those memories and to remind people of that history.
Back to Juan Guaido, who does seem to have a lot of support, and as you say, he's very charismatic. Why doesn't Maduro just arrest him?
Well, I think it's because the price at this stage would be too high. The U.S. has made it very clear that there would be very serious consequences if he were to do that, without saying what those consequences might be. I think it's the case that Maduro does consider the possibility of a U.S. Military intervention at some point to be a real one, and one that he dreads. So he's tiptoed very carefully around the issue of arresting Guaido. When Guaido went out of the country recently, he was able to come back through the front door. Literally, he came in through Caracas International Airport, which is an unusual thing for someone who is violating a travel ban imposed by the Maduro-controlled Supreme Court, and who had also denounced that he's the actual rightful president of the country. But he walked right back in, and no one touched him. Since then, Maduro's toughened up in the sense that you're seeing more soldiers, more repressive tactics, and he arrested the chief of staff of Guaido's office. So he's come close, but he hasn't so far touched Guaido himself. And I think the reason for that is exactly because he's extremely concerned about the consequences of that would then follow. There would be a huge international outcry.
So he's chipped away at Juan Guaido's supporters, but not Guaido himself.
Yes, especially the arrest of the chief of staff was a significant move because that's a senior position, someone who's very close to Guaido, but not Guaido himself. And that has fueled speculation that Maduro is gradually maneuvering himself into a position where he might feel strong enough to go after Guaido. But clearly he doesn't feel that moment has yet arrived. And as I say, Warren, I think the response in the international media and on the international stage generally, especially in Washington, would be an extremely strong one.
What about the role of evangelicals in Venezuela, who are supported, of course, by Vice President Pence?
Well, I can enlighten you in one area, and that is in Brazil. The evangelical church has grown in its influence markedly. It really has soared in popularity over the last 3 or 4 decades and played a very important part in the election of Jair Bolsonaro as president, who won in a landslide last year and took office in January. Bolsonaro is from the far right. He enjoys considerable military support, and indeed he has 8 members, military men in his cabinet, and he is a very strong foe of Venezuela. He's on precisely the same page as Donald Trump, but with the exception that he does not support military intervention in Venezuela. And the arrival on the scene, as it were, as a strong ally of the U.S. and others in the region who are opposing Maduro of Brazil was an important moment. It kind of somewhat changed the landscape, and the evangelical church had a part to play in that.
All right, we've heard the president and Elliot Abrams talk tough about Russian troops in Venezuela. Here's the National Security Advisor John Bolton, another hawk going back for decades.
We wanted to make it very clear to Russia, China, Cuba, anybody who might be assisting the Maduro regime, that we consider Maduro illegitimate and we consider assistance to his government contrary to the best interests of the Venezuelan people. We don't want to see this escalate. We've said repeatedly we want a peaceful transition from the Maduro regime to Juan Guaido. That remains our objective. We have not militarily intervened in Venezuela, that's clear, but Russia and Cuban military forces are there. That's not a good situation, again, for the people of Venezuela.
So does this have the potential to be another proxy war situation where American and Russian troops might end up in Venezuela at the same time?
Well, it's quite difficult to, especially for Russia, which is in economic terms so much smaller than the United States. It's difficult for Moscow to kind of extend its reach into Venezuela in a very big way, in a way that's big enough to bring about a sort of a face-to-face confrontation with the U.S. I think it's more as a political pressure point, more because they want to make sure that they have a say in whatever dispensation emerges if there is a post-Maduro government, and more also because I think Putin gains somewhat by being able to show his domestic audience, who still have fond memories of the Soviet era, of their comradely relationships in Latin America, particularly in Cuba, obviously. And I think that's what it's more about, whether the Russians would want to bring this to a point where temperatures would raise and you would see a kind of a potential face down in terms of there being Russian military presence in Venezuela and American military, a North American military presence. I rather doubt that.
So back to the beginning, when we talked about American sanctions, first in January with the oil sanctions and now the reinforcement of them this past week, do you think that they have the capacity to weaken the Maduro government to the point where there really might be some kind of revolutionary activity with the government going out and Guaido coming in?
Well, collapsing an economy on its own doesn't necessarily do the trick. If you're thinking of it through the perspective of Washington, let's recall what happened in Zimbabwe, North Korea. It's possible that these sanctions, which will undoubtedly hit Venezuela very hard, they're beginning to kick in and they're going to do a lot more economic damage in the coming months, that those sanctions could trigger some kind of popular uprising. But on the other hand, this is a population that is exhausted, it's depleted, and the poorer it gets, the more it has to focus on the daily business of just getting by. Remembering that, as I said earlier, 3.4 million of them have left the country. Those are often the get-up-and-go people, the ones with initiative who've gone out there to take their talents to other economies because they couldn't get any income out of the Venezuelan one anymore, and to send some of their money home to support their families. They're out of the mix. So it's I certainly don't feel that it's likely that we would see that. I think it's more possible that we'll just see prolonged suffering and maybe some sort of maneuvering towards a negotiated settlement in which parts of the existing government, by which I mean the Chavistas and maybe elements of the military, might in some way be combined with the opposition in a move towards taking the country towards new elections, but without Maduro. So the Chavistas, who still enjoy a degree of popularity in Venezuela, might be part of that formula. But that's really hard, too. I mean, you'd have to reform the Electoral Commission, which is Maduro-controlled. It would require all sorts of negotiations over things like the release of political prisoners. And you can be pretty sure that the Maduro government would want the U.S. sanctions to be lifted first. So this is a long, hard road, and I can't honestly, Warren, tell you how it's going to or where it's going to end.
So you've been in Venezuela a lot over the past couple of years. You're talking to us, however, from Rio. You are the South American correspondent for NPR. In general, what about America's image, its reputation, its impact in the countries south of the border? What can you say about it?
Well, I'm the South American correspondent. We also have a correspondent in Mexico. It's interesting because in Europe and in much of the United States, one gets used to hearing a large amount of criticism of the Trump administration. In Brazil, where I've spent a lot of time reporting recently, and also in Venezuela amongst the opposition to Maduro, you meet fans of Donald Trump. In Brazil, it's because they support Jair Bolsonaro and are pleased to see that Brazil has realigned itself on the map become a closer partner with the United States, despite the fact that China is its number one trading partner. And in Venezuela, of course, it's because the opposition hope that the U.S. will finally get rid of Maduro and are pleased with the degree of support that it's given to the opposition so far. All that said, you don't need to travel all that far in the region to find plenty of people who are very uneasy with the U.S. at this time. And of course, the migration crisis has caused deep deep unhappiness among South Americans. They were very unimpressed with family separation, and they remain distrustful for those historic reasons that we talked about of the U.S. in general and Donald Trump in particular.
South American correspondent for NPR, Philip Reeves, thank you so much for joining us. It's just been terrific.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
In a moment, another crisis south of the border, President Trump's denial of aid to three poverty-stricken countries. This is To the Point.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We've talked about Venezuela. Now to Central America, where Washington historically has protected commercial exploitation and allied itself with repressive regimes and movements. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan sold arms to Nicaragua's pro-government Contras in their fight against the communist Sandinistas. Now, natives of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are crowding the Mexican border, seeking refuge in the U.S. from some of the world's most violent countries. President Trump's response? He's cutting foreign assistance.
We were paying them tremendous amounts of money, and we're not paying them anymore.
Anita Isaacs is a professor at Haverford College. She's co-director of the Migration Encounters Oral History Project, and she's been researching and writing about war and reconciliation and democracy in Guatemala. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How important is American aid to these countries?
American aid should be much more important than it is. It's actually a drop in the bucket. It's equivalent to just 1% of the total foreign assistance budget. So we're talking really about very, very small amounts that are being sent to Central America, to a region that is in desperate need of foreign assistance.
How important is American aid to these countries?
American aid to these countries is relatively unimportant from the perspective of the U.S. foreign assistance budget. At $500 million, U.S. foreign aid to Central America represents less than 1% of the U.S. foreign assistance project. For poor communities and violent-ridden communities in Central America, however, it is their only lifeline, in fact, to safety and security, albeit a minimal one.
Does it get directly to them, the money that comes from the United States?
So the money that comes from the United States is distributed in a variety of ways. The bulk of the aid goes to foreign contractors who distribute the aid to NGOs, church communities, and a variety of nonprofits, and sometimes to community organizations. So it is filtered through, in sort of the vast majority of it, through to U.S. AID, which is the U.S. Internet Assistance Agency, to contractors who then distribute the aid.
So it doesn't go directly then to the people. Is it well administered? Does it really help?
So in thinking about the aid, I think we need to make sort of two distinctions. If we look back over the past few years, the portion of the assistance, which is about half, that was directed to security and violence prevention has actually had an impact in terms of reducing the violence, most notably in El Salvador, where the homicide rate has been cut in half. And it's fair to say that aid has been, U.S. assistance has been a contributing factor in those improvements. Where aid is more problematic, from my perspective, is in the distribution of economic development assistance. And I know that really firsthand from my work in Guatemala. That aid is distributed by, as I mentioned earlier, by foreign contractors who arrive in communities with projects that they have in mind as necessary, that are rather than projects that bubble up from the bottom, that are grassroots, what communities define as their needs. Also, they are distributed in large bulk sums, which often very small communities from which these prospective migrants leave are ill-equipped to absorb. And so the aid itself becomes problematic because it is ill-suited for the needs of the community, and it is not distributed in a fashion that communities can absorb, nor, I would add, is it distributed in a manner that allows these communities to promote self-sustaining development over the longer term. Once that foreign assistance grant has terminated, has ended, these communities are back to square one. And so we need to think hard about how we distribute foreign assistance. The solution, I hasten to add, is I'm not advocating for cutting off aid. I'm advocating, in fact, for providing more assistance and for ensuring, especially with regard to economic development assistance, that it actually reach intended communities and respond to communities' needs in a self-sustaining fashion.
Will cutting it off encourage the countries involved, the governments involved, as President Trump has said, to try to prevent people from leaving their countries and coming to the United States?
Absolutely, categorically, no. What cutting off aid is doing is punishing the wrong people. Rather than punishing governments for their role, and they do have a role in facilitating migration, and we can talk about that, they're in fact punishing the poorest of the poor and victims of poverty, I would say, and victims of violence. By cutting off aid, we're sanctioning the wrong people. We're sanctioning the poor rather than the governments, who are complicit, admittedly, in the migration of tens of thousands of their citizens.
President Trump has said that a lot of the aid goes into the hands of gangs. Is that true, or is it going to corrupt officials in addition to the contractors that you mentioned?
A very small portion is going into the hands of corrupt government officials. There is absolutely no evidence to support that money is landing in the hands of gangs. The violence prevention programs are probably the most effective piece of that aid, in addition to some of the anti-corruption efforts and rule of law that are being scaled back now. And the economic development assistance is the least effective, but there's no evidence that gangs are receiving this aid.
You mentioned that some of the aid goes to churches. Vice President Pence has talked a lot about that. Is there a connection with evangelicals in the United States?
Yes, there's a sad connection, in fact, between evangelicals in the United States and evangelicals in positions of power in these countries. And again, most especially in the case of Guatemala, what we've seen sort of during the Trump administration has been a government where evangelicals are in prominent positions of power who have used their positions of power and their religion to build, to foster ties with their counterparts in the U.S. So one way in which what is nothing more than an organized, corrupt criminal regime has tried to curry favor with American government officials is by playing the evangelical card. You have officials from the Guatemalan government who have come to Washington. They've attended prayer breakfasts with their counterparts in the U.S. Congress. This has been one way in which they tried to get the U.S. government to turn a blind eye to the corrupt criminal regime that's in power in Guatemala today.
So is that also true of Honduras and El Salvador? And have all of these countries showed support for the Trump administration in other parts of the world?
It's true in the case of Honduras and less true in the case of El Salvador. But it's especially true in the case of Guatemala on the evangelical front. The other thing that these governments have done to try to curry favor and to get the Trump administration to ignore corruption and organized crime that has captured the governments in both these countries is to basically play lapdog to the Trump administration. And the most obvious example that comes to mind as I talk to you is that both Honduras and Guatemala are among the handful of countries that agreed to move their embassies from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, for example. They did it immediately. They're doing whatever they can to build a basis of support with the Trump administration so that they can remain in power.
A lot of the people who are coming to the U.S. border have families or other relationships with people in this country. In Los Angeles, it is said that there may be more Salvadorans than there are in the city of San Salvador itself. How important are the residents of the United States who have relations with their people back in their home countries?
Well, the relationship is absolutely critical, and it is a factor in driving migration, but it's also the major factor in it, one of the major factors in allowing people to stay in their countries. The remittances or the money that migrants living in the United States send back home to their communities is either the first or second largest source of revenue in these countries. So it's extremely important, and it's sort of the amount, $19 billion a year, you know, $500 million in foreign assistance pales in comparison to $17 to $19 billion of remittances that migrants from the region send back each year to their home communities. So that's a very important tie. I think that what we're seeing is we're seeing entire families leaving and crossing the border and sort of attempting to cross the border into the United States. Now, a very small part of that has to do with what we call family reunification. The real reason why we're seeing the uprooting of families and this massive surge in families attempting to cross the border is the total desperation provoked by the violence and the poverty in the region. Children wouldn't be crossing the border. Children would be staying in their home countries if there was any possibility of surviving there.
Let me just ask you, you said that the remittances are the first or second source of revenue in these countries. What are the other sources of revenue?
Well, it depends on the country. These are mainly agricultural export economies. There's also mining and mineral exports from these countries. These countries are exporters of either raw materials or of agricultural products.
Is there a lot of unemployment?
The majority of the workforce in these countries are unemployed. In roughly two-thirds to three-quarters of the workforce is what we call employed in what we call the informal sector, which means that they don't have properly salaried jobs that are regular forms of employment. They're street vendors. They sell chewing gum or other things on the streets. They're employed as domestic workers, or they have no employment whatsoever.
If the U.S. is, in fact, not advancing its own interests, really, by cutting this very tiny amount of aid that goes to those countries, what could the United States do to try to prevent these mass migrations?
Okay, so the sliver of truth or the sliver of hope in what President Trump has done is to shine a spotlight where it hasn't been shone before, which is on the role of Central American governments in contributing to the surge in migration. Central American governments are complicit in the migration of their citizens, both because they are corrupt criminal regimes, Honduras and Guatemala, less so El Salvador, who repress their citizens and who capture resources that should be allocated to the welfare of their citizens. The other thing is that they're also governments that have historically been indifferent to the plight of their poor. And so they're only too happy. They both cause the conditions that generate the migration and are indifferent to the fact that their citizens are migrating. So efforts to improve the rule of law and to hold governments, politicians, and members of the business community who are corrupt and tied to organized crime accountable, to signal them, to revoke their visas, to freeze their assets, to take all kinds of measures to punish the real wrongdoers who are corrupt politicians and corrupt members of the business community is the way to get these Central American governments to pay attention to the migration crisis. It's the most effective means. What these countries need is more democracy. And more democracy is the key to reducing migration.
Historically speaking, I think Ronald Reagan's assistant to the Contras is probably the best known example. But has the United States ever taken the kinds of steps that you're suggesting?
No, they haven't, although it's always been in the U.S.'s interests, actually, to be truly, rather than just rhetorically, supportive of human rights and democracy in the region. It's never served the U.S.'s interests to support authoritarian repressive regimes, which has been the hallmark of U.S. policy towards Latin America, and especially in the case of Central America. So what we're seeing today is an opportunity, perhaps, to get it right. If the U.S. administration is actually serious about curbing migration or alleviating migration, then addressing those root causes means encouraging more democracy and more respect for human rights and more respect both political and civil liberties, but also the economic and social rights of the majority of its citizens. It's absolutely clear to anyone who looks at the region that migration is a reflection of poverty and violence, and that the governments in power have the capacity, but don't have the will to take the measures to actually address these root causes of migration.
But doing what you're suggesting on the part of the United States would mean a real change, almost a reversal of policy from a historical standpoint.
Yes, one always has to hope that the U.S. will finally see the light and understand that its interests and the interests of the citizenry of these countries are actually consistent and congruent, and that both the citizens of Central America and the U.S. government and U.S. citizens share a common interest in having a region that is respectful of democracy and human rights.
Anita Isaacs at Haverford College, also with the Migration Encounters Oral History Project. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Today's program was produced by Andrea Brody. We had audio assistance from Chris Watherspoon. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetari. I'm Armin Alney. Our Twitter handle is tothepoint_KCRW. I'm at warren.alney@kcrw.org. Let us hear from you, and when you go online, leave a review.